This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
You to follow Egypt with Sharifa Bokhdus. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 5 o'clock straight up. It's time for the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast the 26th annual Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. Thursday through Sunday, July 4th through 7th, KBOO will be broadcasting live from Tom McCall Waterfront Park for the Portland metro area and throughout the state with our partners in Ashland, Bend, Newport, Salem, Warm Springs, and more. Internet listeners can tune in to KBOO.fm. Again, that's the 26th annual Waterfront Blues Festival, a benefit for the Oregon Food Bank, because no one should be hungry. More information on costs, benefit to KBOO members, performing artists, and more can be found at kboo.fm.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This program was also made possible in part by Friends of KBOO, supporting locally produced, organically grown, homemade programming for Portland and the world. Thanks KBOO for 45 years of music, current affairs, and live broadcasts. Friends of KBOO can be reached at 503-788-2533.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has been removed by the Egyptian military.
Incarcerated civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart was denied compassionate release.
And the Oregon State Legislature has voted to conduct a performance audit into TriMet.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 3rd, 2013. I'm Owen Bastable.
And I'm Nia Lewis. The Oregon State Legislature has moved to conduct a state-run performance audit into TriMet as a fast-tracked amendment to House Bill 3316, which looks to overhaul TriMet's ailing governance. The focus of the investigation is the transparency, governance, operations, and finance due to mounting complaints, ongoing labor disputes, threats of service cuts, and its reputation for bureaucratic red tape. Secretary of State Kate Brown will conduct the comprehensive investigation, calling the audit a clear signal from the governor and legislature. The audit is awaiting Governor Kitzhaber's signature and is to be completed by the end of the year. The audit will give the public a look into the clandestine internal audit process of one of the largest public transportation budgets in the nation. The move to conduct an audit was sponsored primarily by Representative Chris Gorsuch, a self-professed longtime user of TriMet. Only one member of the House was opposed to the audit. TriMet issued a statement yesterday stating it will be fully responsive and is in support of a performance audit.
Today in the Oregon legislature, the Senate passed a bill that will curb certain forms of motorized mining, including suction dredge mining. During the testimony, some Republicans spoke against the bill, claiming that suction dredge mining is a recreational activity, while others spoke in favor based on private property rights.
And much of the recreation and small business mining that goes on in Oregon, particularly suction dredge mining, occurs in that area in eastern Oregon that includes Baker and Grant County and some of the oldest mining districts in the country, Greenhorn, the town of Greenhorn, and Some of you have seen some of the reality television shows that detail some of the mining practices that still go on there. But I want to tell you that suction dredge mining plays a big part of what occurs there, in not only just for recreation, but it's part of the custom and culture of how people make a living there. Back to 1862. Is suction dredge mining annoying? Possibly. Nobody likes to hear that power mower sound running in the river, and that is annoying. And the answer to that problem is perhaps more in the neighborhood of recreation management planning than it is in a ban or a limitation or a rollback. There's no documentation on damage to the rivers or the ecosystems. This is just what I would call an exercise in increasing people's anxiety. People believe we ought to do something, so this is what the plan that the legislature's come up with.
We've had a lot of landowners come to us quietly and say, don't tell Myers I said this, don't let them know who I am, but I don't want them on my land anymore. They've caused a lot of damage, a lot of problems for me, and they intimidate me, and that's been very real.
The bill regulating suction dredge mining in Oregon rivers passed the Oregon Senate today and goes to the governor's desk for a signature.
Senate Bill 270 passed today, making way for the seven universities governed by the Oregon University System to have independent institutional boards. The Associated Students of Portland State University are one of the groups opposed to such an action. Eric Knoll, the Legislative Affairs Director for the Associated Students of Portland State University, spoke with KABU reporter Jamai Cherry.
As far as Senate Bill 270, can you give me a little background on it?
Yeah, so my understanding with Senate Bill 270 is that it will create institutional boards at Portland State University and the University of Oregon, with the option for Oregon State University to create an institutional board as well. And now, as amended, it would also give the option to regional schools such as Southern, Western, Eastern, and Oregon Institute of Technology to have institutional boards if they choose to do so in the next couple of years. And these institutional boards for PSU and U of O would comprise of 11 to 15 members to serve, I believe, 2 or 4 year terms, depending on who they are, in their position. And then they would serve essentially as a board of trustees for the university and have the power to set tuition under, I believe, 5% and make other decisions that would normally be made at the OUS level.
So what would be some of the, I guess, benefits or drawbacks of SB 270 passing? Like, as far as, let's just look at Portland State University as our example.
Yeah, yeah. So proponents of Senate Bill 270, from my understanding, believe that passage of institutional boards would allow a greater level of philanthropy to come in to the universities and therefore allow people to contribute a lot more financially, whereas they wouldn't have done so before. It will also allow the university to have more freedoms outside of statewide Oregon University system. In terms of some of the drawbacks that we see as students, we're very concerned with the tuition-setting ability of these boards and how relatable they will be to the needs of students. Currently, there's a cap of a 5% tuition increase per year, and if they want to go above that, they have to go to the state legislature or the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to get approval for that. But even at a level of 5% tuition increase per year, if they chose to increase tuition by 5% every year, it would double in 10 years. And so affordability is a major concern of students, and if it becomes unaffordable for many students, it becomes an access issue as well. We're also concerned in making sure that we have student representation on these boards. Right now, the legislation does give a voting student seat, but at the same time, a single seat on a board of 11 to 15 can drown out a voice quite easily. So we're always hoping for more student, we're always looking to advocate for more student involvement. And so we're concerned with student and even staff and faculty's ability to have a voice in the governance and the function of the university if these institutional boards do pass.
What's something that non-students can do as far as raising awareness about the individual boards?
That's a really good question. I would hope that the community takes a lot of involvement in these institutional boards. One of the reasons the proponents give for vying for institutional boards is that it will draw the institution closer to the community. And so while there's been opportunities this session to discuss them in Salem, those opportunities really have passed for the community. But in the event that institutional boards do pass, I would really hope that community members from the Portland area attend these meetings, because they will be open to the public, and to make sure that they are holding accountable the members of the board who themselves are not elected but appointed, which is another one of our concerns. But we will need to rely on the community to hold these boards accountable, to participate in the process and be there. It can't just be students anymore. We need everyone to be involved in making sure that these boards, in the event that they do pass, actually end up benefiting the institution rather than harming it.
That was KBOO reporter Jemai Cherry speaking with Eric Knoll of PSU.
A record $6 billion budget for Oregon public schools and a replacement for the state's recently departed chief education officer were both announced by state officials this week. Teachers, parents, and administrators have all said they hope these measures will improve the state of Oregon's currently lagging schools. In collaboration with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Casey Decker has more.
July started off with a bang for Oregon schools. It wasn't fireworks. There's a new state education budget and a new chief education officer. The Oregon Education Investment Board selected an interim chief from its own ranks after last month's departure of Dr. Rudy Crew. She is Dr. Nancy Golden, who recently retired as superintendent of the Springfield Public Schools. Hannah Vandering represents the Oregon Education Association on the board and says Golden is a practical choice, with 30 years of education experience in the state.
She's demonstrated the ability to work together with everyone, parents, students, and educators, to really build something in Springfield that makes a difference for students.
Dr. Golden will take the helm at the OEIB for up to 6 months starting in August. Vandering says in its meeting on Monday, the board did not discuss the process it will use to select a permanent chief education officer. The Oregon House also approved the new education budget of $6.5 billion, which is $1 billion over the current school funding level. The new school budget is mostly a direct appropriation, but includes $200 million from reductions in the public employees' retirement system. The additional money won't bring back every canceled program or laid off staff member, but Otto Schell with the Oregon PTA says it's an important turning point after cutting school funding for years.
I took a lot of comfort from the fact that in a bipartisan way, both Democrats and Republicans from all over, from rural and urban places, said we're not there yet, that even with the improved budget, we can and we should do better.
With both House and Senate approval, the education budget bill now goes to the governor's desk. This is the largest education budget ever in Oregon, but lawmakers acknowledge that some school districts are so far behind that they will still have to make cuts to balance their budgets. For KBOO News, in association with the Oregon News Service, I'm Casey Decker.
The Oregon State House and Senate both unanimously voted this week to approve a plan that would allow students to pay for college by committing a small percentage of their future income. Paying for college usually means forking over tens of thousands of dollars a year or facing massive student loan debt in the years afterwards. The legislation would allow students with entry-level jobs who earn very little to pay an affordable percentage of their income to the state. This policy, the first of its kind in the U.S., contrasts with the traditional loans that require students to pay back interest, sending many into bankruptcy. The concept was first brought to the attention of lawmakers by a Portland State University professor and a group of her students, and was quickly moved to the top of the agenda. The law would apply only to Oregon State schools.
This fall, Tiger Tualatin middle and high schools will have designated unisex bathrooms. The new designation comes in response to concerns from transgender students in the district. Transgender students are often the target of bullying and harassment from their peers, according to a recent report by the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network. The unisex bathrooms will be single occupancy stalls, previously designated for staff use. No new construction will take place in the schools, and the bathrooms will be available for all students to use. Grant High School was the first school in Portland Public District to designate six bathrooms as gender neutral last spring. Tigard and Tualatin schools will also include private and curtained areas and locker rooms, and they have updated their student rights handbook to include a commitment to equal facilities access for all students.
A Corvallis-based company called New Scale Power has applied for a Department of Energy grant to build small modular nuclear reactors. The company claims that the new class of nuclear reactors they are developing are safer, cheaper, and easier to build than conventional nukes. They say that their design innovations would resist the type of disaster that led to multiple nuclear meltdowns in Fukushima, Japan in 2011. The NuScale reactor is a 45-megawatt reactor vessel that would be installed underground in large pools of water and linked in arrays of up to 12 units, producing up to 540 megawatts of electricity. NuScale asserts that because their design uses natural convection currents rather than complicated pump systems to circulate cooling water around the radioactive core, they can shut the reactor down without any electrical power or operator input in the event of a Fukushima-like emergency. But environmental groups like Greenpeace say that such statements are a type of, quote, greenwashing, unquote, in which nuclear power companies try to assert that nuclear energy is eco-friendly while downplaying the risks.
A chemical spill at Pacific Coast Fruit resulted in the evacuation of 150 employees and one injury. Portland Fire, Hazmat, and five other units responded to the business around 11:30 a.m. on Tuesday. Employees of Pacific Fruit say they smelled a strong odor and noticed it was harder to breathe due to the spill. One employee reported seeing the acid dripping down the ceilings and walls. The substance that spilled is Percan A, an acid containing hydrogen peroxide, acetic acid, and water. The acid has a pungent smell like vinegar or onions. Lieutenant Rich Chapman, a spokesman for Portland Fire Bureau, estimates that about 2 gallons spilled. The acid that spilled is used in diluted form to wash and sanitize fruit. A hazmat crew contained the leak. Pacific Fruit reports the fruit should be safe.
An 18-year-old imprisoned at the Coffee Creek Women's Prison in Wilsonville was found dead in her cell just after midnight this morning. Prison authorities say that they are awaiting a report from the medical examiners to determine a cause of death. Precious Anderson, age 18, was alone in her cell when she died, according to Coffee Creek prison officials. Coffee Creek is Oregon's only prison for women and houses over 1,200 women in minimum and medium security facilities.
A new online group called Restore the Fourth, with the support of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, has begun protests and public debates calling for the government to adhere to the Fourth Amendment and to end surveillance of the American people. Restore the Fourth has organized an event tomorrow at noon at O'Brien Square in Portland. The group said in a press release 2 weeks ago that it wants to reform parts of the Patriot Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. KBOO's Ben Renner spoke with Max Orhai of Restore the Fourth about the protest and the issues at hand.
And you want to make this clear that this is not just a protest, it's more...
It's a forum to have sort of a public conversation. And one thing that has been of particular concern to me watching the story unfold is the way that the corporate media has sort of spun it and turned it into sort of a wild goose chase about this character, Edward Snowden. and not so much about what he was trying to reveal. And so this is an opportunity for people to show up and talk to each other. The Patriot Act was sort of railroaded through Congress at the last minute. Some of the wording was, you know, changed shortly before lawmakers could vote on it. And it's been recently renewed again. And I think a lot of our congressmen aren't even aware of sort of what's in there. And certainly a lot of the public are not aware. But basically, you know, with this FISA court, which stands for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, we should probably take the F off, because it turns out it's, you know, they do domestic surveillance as well. And the legality of this is something that should be and is being challenged in court.
The FISA Act is sort of being used as a surveillance law for everyone.
You know, we've had some misinformation about that and continue to sort of get obfuscation from some of our high-ranking officials. We have contacted people within Occupy, within the Tea Party, within Republicans and Democrats. Like I said, it's supposed to reach everybody, regardless of their political affiliations, because this is an issue that affects everyone.
Yeah.
Anybody who's aware of this, if they're not outraged, then they're in denial.
That was KBOO's Ben Renner speaking with Max Orhei of Restore the Fourth. Another of Restore the Fourth's stated purposes was to bring public officials who were responsible for the surveillance to justice. One official mentioned by Orhei was James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence, who issued a formal apology to Congress for lying about NSA surveillance of American citizens. When questioned formally by Senator Ron Wyden in March, Clapper denied the NSA data collections. Restore the Fourth also wants to create a special committee to expose the extent of NSA surveillance on the public.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news after this newscast, followed by Treasures from the Archive at 6, with a recording from Lynn Stewart from 2003 and Robert Pete Williams from 1970. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be beautiful for the birthday of our great nation, mostly sunny with a high of 75 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's 5:22, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Mothers the world over have told their children a zillion times, stop playing with your food. I now share their frustration and would like to yell at the conglomerate packagers of America's victuals, stop playing with our food. Actually, they're playing with our heads, using dishonest packaging tactics to raise their prices without us noticing it. A 16-ounce carton of something, quietly slips to 14 ounces, but does not drop in price. Then there's the dimple trick. A jar of Hellman's mayonnaise, for example, has had its contents shrunk, yet the new jar looks as big as the old one, unless you turn it on its end. There, you'll find a big indention in the bottom, a hidden way to shrink the capacity of the jar and give you less for your money. David Siegel, who writes the Hagler column in the New York Times, recently reported on his adventures in Kraft Foods land. He talked to a PR lady there about the corporation's unpublicized but rather dramatic change in its Baker's brand of cooking chocolate. Instead of an 8-ounce package selling for $3.89, suddenly a box of Baker's contained only 4 ounces of chocolate, which sells for $2.89. Wow, that's nearly a 50% price hike per ounce. What gives? Siegel asked the Kraft spokeswoman. The change was consumer-driven, she craftily replied. Our consumers have told us that they prefer this smaller size. Sure, said Siegel, but what about that slippery price? She was as slippery as the price, declaring that the product is competitively priced. That was not the question, but her whole game is to avoid giving the honest answer. We're gouging our customers. This is Jim Hightower saying, conglomerate food packagers not only feel free to dupe us consumers, but also they're considering such corporate chicanery to be a legitimate business practice.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, Visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Egyptian army announced the removal of President Morsi from power today. General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi declared the removal of Morsi and suspension of the constitution in a national television broadcast on Muslim Brotherhood TV. The head of the constitutional court, Adli al-Mansur, has been named interim head of state. Al-Sisi said they have established a roadmap for the future of the country to be led by the National Reconciliation Committee. It includes the formation of a technocratic national government, guarantees for freedom of the press, and a commitment to include youth movements in decision-making. According to a statement released on Morsi's Facebook page today, he has rejected the military's action as a full military coup. Morsi is currently in an undisclosed location in Egypt. It is not clear whether or not he is under arrest. Supporters of Morsi, mainly from the Muslim Brotherhood, reacted angrily to the news in Cairo, while anti-Morsi crowds set off fireworks and celebrated the news. 39 people have been killed in protests since Sunday. We'll have a full report from Cairo later this hour on Free Speech Radio News. Stay tuned.
The world-famous civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart has been denied her request for compassionate release. The 74-year-old lawyer is suffering from stage 4 cancer and says she is disappointed but not devastated by the decision. She was imprisoned for releasing a statement on behalf of her client, a man known as the Blind Sheikh. Stewart's husband, Ralph Pointer, spoke today with KBOO's Chris Andre about the case.
This case of Lynn Stewart is the tip of the iceberg, and it is one of the beginnings. I know it has started in many places of people telling the truth to the American public about what our government, so-called our government, is about. And Lynn's initial sin was when she was defending the sheikh, the blind sheikh, who was accused of terror in New York's blowing up New York City landmarks. She exposed the government informant and put the government smack dab in the middle of World Trade Center 1. And I believe this is why the government goes after her to silence her, because she has memory, and she can speak in a manner in which people listen. And when if anyone goes to the trial of the blind sheikh, and I believe it was 1993, when Lynn cross-examined Emad Salem, you can hear the public record of how she exposed the American government and how the judge cut her off and told her her cross-examination was not relevant. And Lynn responded that the cross-examination she was going through was to show the quality of Emad Salem's testimony, to destroy his testimony, and she caught him lying over 30 times that he admitted to, and she says it would destroy the credibility of all of his testimony. But in that destruction of his credibility, she exposed the American government's involvement in World Trade Center 1. And after Lynn was tried for supplying her client, who was in jail all of the time, to a so-called terrorist organization, and she was found guilty, Lynn Kinserberg continued to travel around the country to law schools and universities, debating the Bill of Rights versus the Patriot Act, and talking about her case and all of the problems with her case. To begin with, the selective prosecution of Lynn Stewart. And so now we've established the government's reason for going after her, and we'll look into how they did it. Now, when I say selective prosecution, it is based on the fact that Ramsey Clark and Abdeen Jabara both attorneys on the same case had made press releases previous to Lynn Stewart's press release. And the whole case is based on a press release that Lynn made through Reuters. The government said it was secret messages. Now, all you have to do is look at Reuters, and the last time I looked, Reuters, I think, was the second largest information or press company in the world, press service, and the government categorized it as secret information that it was coded that anybody could look at, and nobody has coded it, and it was a very straightforward message that the government characterized as secret and someone might have been hurt. Well, no one ever was hurt, but Lynn is in jail dying of cancer because of a press release that other people had made before she did. And lawyers defending clients accused of terrorism continue to violate the special administrative measures. That's what they accused Lynn of doing, violating a prison regulation that said you should not make press releases on behalf of the client. Other lawyers continue to violate special administrative measures, prison regulations, and they violate court orders in talking to their clients and releasing information to and about their clients, and yet no one else has been prosecuted, more or less put in jail. So Lynn Stewart, we say selective prosecution because nobody else gets prosecuted. It's like two people walking down the street, one person spits on the sidewalk and nothing happens, the next person spits on the sidewalk and gets the death penalty.
That was Ralph Pointer, the husband of imprisoned attorney Lynn Stewart. More information can be found on the website lynnstewart.org.
Exemption 5 of the Freedom of Information Act allows government agencies to conceal from the public certain communications within the agency and between agencies. In 2001, the Supreme Court ruled that this applied to private consultants hired by the government, but that those were exceptional cases and that the law did not apply to all contractors. In a recent ruling by an appeals court regarding a case about military housing built by a contractor, the verdict stated that communications between government agencies and contractors could also be kept secret from the public. With government work such as national security and the maintenance of prisons increasingly being outsourced to private contractors, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press is appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court to review the decision in the interest of transparency. For more on the story, KBOO's Jennifer Kemp spoke with Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press attorney Aaron Mackey about his thoughts on the case.
Your organization, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, is calling for the Supreme Court to review a decision by an appeals court allowing secrecy about communications between the federal government and private contractors. Why do you find this lack of transparency to be problematic?
Well, I mean, there are a number of reasons. One of the main principal reasons is that increasingly, government agencies are enlisting private contractors to conduct government functions. So we see this in prison contracting, we see it in areas such as national security, and a bunch of other areas. And so, you know, if FOIA's purpose is to increase transparency and citizens' knowledge about its government's activities, we also think that that transparency should follow when you have private companies conducting government functions on behalf of the government.
In 2001, the Supreme Court stated that Exemption 5, the part of the Freedom of Information Act in question, only applies to actual government agencies. Why is it now being extended to private contractors?
Well, I mean, that's one of our arguments. There is a small exception under the law that allows for consultants that are hired by the agencies of the federal government to handle particular questions. So if an agency has an issue come up where they need outside expertise and they employ an private contractor or a private individual to conduct that sort of, a study or answer a question or something like that, they can be treated like they are members of the government, and sort of their correspondence can be shielded. And that makes some sense because they're acting essentially like an employee. What's happening here is you have a private company that's interested in obtaining government contracts and is interested in doing government business. That's a lot different than sort of a private consultant answering a particular question. And they're just, under the Fourth Circuit analysis, they're allowed to sort of withhold these documents from public disclosure.
Talk about a real-world example in which this would come into play. And you sort of mentioned this earlier when you talked about how there's prison contractors and national security contractors. But what kind of contractors are we talking about here under current law? What types of communications could be concealed?
Well, in this case in particular, the real example is you have contractors who were employed by the Army to provide military housing facilities on forts and military installations throughout the country. And here, this very case arises out of a dispute between two different contractors. One contractor accused another contractor of basically some misdeeds, allegations of fraud and malfeasance and that sort of thing. And there's litigation that's going on about that as to whether or not that contractor should be removed from providing housing to the government. What happened in that case was the other contractor that had been accused of these misdeeds was trying to seek the correspondence between the other contractor and the military. So you have basically, anything that they're communicating about related to doing the government's work and these allegations of fraud being shielded from public disclosure, when those are the very types of situations where, the performance of a contractor and by extension the performance of the government is called into question.
Why is it important for the public to know about these communications?
Well, I think, there could be a lot of reasons, and it's always hard to tell in specific instances what those communications might say, but anytime you have an allegation of impropriety involving the government, and that could include misuse of government money, it could include just sort of waste and fraud and misdeeds by officials, it's important that the public have a full understanding of what occurred, and documents like this would obviously contribute to that public understanding so that, the public, which ultimately has oversight over the government, can determine what they would like to do.
And do you have anything else you'd like to add?
Well, we just think it's an important case, and we hope that the Supreme Court weighs the arguments and ultimately agrees to hear the case.
Well, thanks so much for talking to me, Aaron.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking to Aaron Mackey of an attorney for the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. This is Jennifer Kemp with KBOO News.
In a special session of the Texas State Legislature focusing entirely on limiting women's productive rights, a version of the controversial bill has passed through committee. The bill failed last week following a 10-hour filibuster by State Senator Wendy Davis, but is being reinstated by Republican Congress members. It will now go to the full House for a vote. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Alan Shearer of the Trust Women Silver Ribbon Campaign.
And I wonder if you could talk about some of the main concerns that you have with this special session of the Texas legislature.
In addition to the specifics of what they are trying to do, which is really to pass restrictions on all clinics in Texas that do anything to perform abortions, there would only be five sites left in the state of Texas that would be legally able to perform abortions. It's part of this really frightening anti-democratic wave where we know that the majority of Americans are support keeping abortion legal and support access to safe legal abortion and to contraception. And we're seeing this continued wave of really reactionary proposals in state legislatures like Texas.
How is it that these states are able to put restrictions on women's reproductive rights? Doesn't Roe v. Wade prevent states from doing that?
It should, and most of these, when the challenge goes to court, several of these provisions have been found to be unconstitutional. I guess the question is, you know, under this continued assault, yes, it should be a constitutionally protected right, but clearly some of these provisions are being tried with the intent of going to what is now a pretty conservative Supreme Court.
Can you talk about Wendy Davis, the senator in Texas that engaged in a filibuster? What was it that she actually did, and why is it significant?
Texas State Senator Wendy Davis employed a Texas law that allows members of the legislature to conduct a filibuster. They have to stand on their feet the whole time that they're filibustering. They can't lean. They can't touch the table. She had a back problem. She went in with a special back brace. And she was, again, trying to prevent a vote on this proposal that would have outlawed, placed new restrictions on clinics in Texas, requiring them to rebuild, to be essentially surgery centers, to have to meet all kinds of restrictions. It was a special session of the legislature that was due to end at midnight on Tuesday night, so the legislature had to vote by midnight. If they did not, the vote would not be legal. She was finally shouted down by some Republican state senators who claimed she was talking about extraneous issues relating to other attacks on Planned Parenthood. However, at that point, the gallery was so jammed with protesters who were watching what they were doing, it was so noisy that the legislators weren't able to vote. Wendy Davis certainly showed herself to be a real heroine for democracy and for the movement for women's rights.
I know there are other issues that people in Texas have on their minds, funding of schools, the health care. Why is this getting so much attention?
Well, I think that the people of Texas and many other states have quite a bit on their minds. And I think as we're becoming familiar with a lot of the districts for electing state legislators were pretty well gerrymandered, driven very narrowly after the 2010 census to really only reflect, to give advantages to the most conservative candidates and the most conservative legislators. And I think it's pretty clear that none of them, the folks pursuing this agenda, are not particularly concerned about the economic security and the job security and other elements of democratic rights, frankly, of the populations of their districts and their states.
Again, I've been speaking with Ellen Schaefer. She's the head of the Silver Ribbon Campaign to Trust Women for Reproductive Rights and Justice. Their website, oursilverribbon.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
In North Carolina, the Senate passed a bill containing language further restricting abortion availability in the state. Hundreds of reproductive rights advocates protested at the Capitol this morning. Last night, the Republican-led state Senate added several anti-abortion provisions to a bill banning the use of Sharia law in family courts. The additions were made quickly and with little notice, and even the Republican governor issued a statement criticizing the manner in which it was pushed through. The legislation would ban certain insurance providers from offering abortion coverage and require clinics to meet the same licensing requirements as surgical centers, which would put all but one abortion provider in the state out of business, according to the News and Observer newspaper. The bill will now go to conference to resolve several differences between Senate and House versions.
25 veterans were arrested Sunday for violating a 10 p.m. curfew during an anti-war assembly in New York City. More than 100 veterans and their supporters gathered in New York's Vietnam Veterans Memorial, reading the names of fallen soldiers and calling for an end to U.S. military aggression. Several veterans who feel the memorial should be open at all times stayed past the curfew and were subsequently arrested by police. 22 of the veterans were released with return dates in November. The other three were held overnight before being released Monday with adjournments in contemplation of dismissals.
A 6.1 magnitude earthquake hit Indonesia yesterday, killing at least 24, injuring over 200, and damaging thousands of homes on the island of Sumatra. Most harm was done in districts where major roads were cut off by landslides. Rescue operations have begun, utilizing Indonesian police, military, and Air Force to access survivors. Unknown numbers of people are still trapped under rubble, power is out, and communication is difficult. Many residents are afraid to return to their homes for fear of aftershocks. The region is one of the most seismically active in the world. The 2004 earthquake that killed nearly 250,000 people around the Indian Ocean originated in the same area.
Peruvian authorities said today that two real estate companies have destroyed an ancient pyramid near Lima. The 20-foot-high pyramid was one of 12 discovered in the ancient archaeological site and is estimated to be at least 4,000 years old. Historians believe the pyramid was a cultural center in the pre-ceramic era, predating the Incas by thousands of years. The destruction began over the weekend, and the companies also tried to destroy three other pyramids, but were stopped by spectators. Officials are pressing charges against the companies for the damage.
A U.S. drone strike killed four Taliban militants in the northwest tribal areas of Pakistan. The area was known as a Taliban and Al-Qaeda stronghold. Pakistan officials rejected comments made by Afghan Army General Sharif Mohammed Karmine. Karmine said in an interview that Pakistan, quote, controls the Taliban in Afghanistan and could end the 12-year war in weeks if it was actually committed to peace. The comments underline the deep distrust between Pakistan and Afghanistan and came after months of public spats between the two governments. The U.S. and other countries involved in Afghanistan believe that Pakistan is critical to securing peace in the region after the U.S. troops withdrawal next year.